I do not know what to say, Socrates, for, indeed, I cannot make out whether you are giving your own opinion or only wanting to draw me out.
You forget, my friend, that I neither know nor profess to know anything of these matters. You are the person who is in labor. I am the barren midwife, and this is why I soothe you and offer you one good thing after another, that you may taste them. And I hope that I may at last help to bring your own opinion into the light of day. When this has been accomplished, then we will determine whether what you have brought forth is only a wind egg or a lungenu in birth. Therefore, keep up your spirits and answer like a man what you think.
Ask me.
Then once more, is it your opinion that nothing is but what becomes the good and the noble, as well as all the other things which we were just now mentioning?
When I hear you discoursing in this style, I think that there is a great deal in what you say, and I am very ready to assent.
Let us not leave the argument unfinished, then, for there still remains to be considered an objection which may be raised about dreams and diseases, in particular about madness, and the various illusions of hearing and sight, or of other senses. For you know that in all these cases the Esposippi theory appears to be unmistakably refuted, since in dreams and delusions we certainly have false perceptions, and far from saying that everything is which appears, we should rather say that nothing is which appears. But then, my boy, how can anyone contend that knowledge is perception, or that to every man what appears is?
I am afraid to say, Socrates, that I have nothing to answer, because you rebuked me just now for making this excuse, but I certainly cannot undertake to argue that madmen or dreamers think truly when they imagine, some of them, that they are gods, and others, that they can fly, and are flying in their sleep.
Do you see another question which can be raised about these phenomena, notably about dreaming and waking?
What question?
A question which I think that you must often have heard persons ask. How can you determine whether at this moment we are sleeping, and all our thoughts are a dream, or whether we are awake, and talking to one another in the waking state?
Indeed, Socrates, I do not know how to prove the one any more than the other, for in both cases the facts precisely correspond, and there is no difficulty in supposing that during all this discussion we have been talking to one another in a dream, and when in a dream we seem to be narrating dreams. The resemblance of the two states is quite astonishing.
You see, then, that a doubt about the reality of sense is easily raised, since there may even be a doubt whether we are awake or in a dream. And as a time is equally divided between sleeping and waking, in either sphere of existence the soul contends that the thoughts which are present to our minds at the time are true, and during one half of our lives we affirm the truth of the one, and during the other halt of the other, and are equally confident of both.
Most true.
And may not the same be said of madness and other disorders? The difference is only that the times are not equal.
Certainly.
And is truth or falsehood to be determined by duration of time?
That would be in many ways ridiculous.
But can you certainly determine by any other means which of these opinions is true?
I do not think that I can.
Listen, then, to a statement of the other side of the argument, which is made by the champions of appearance. They would say, as I imagine, can that which is wholly other than something have the same quality as that from which it differs? And observe, Theaetetus, that the word other means not partially, but wholly other.
Certainly, putting the question as you do, that which is wholly other cannot either potentially or in any other way be the same.
And must therefore be admitted to be unlike.
True.
If, then, anything happens to become like or unlike itself or another, when it becomes like we call it the same, when unlike, other.
Certainly.
Were we not saying that there are agents many and infinite, and patients many and infinite?
Yes.
And also that different combinations will produce results which are not the same, but different.
Certainly.
Let us take you and me, or anything as an example. There is Socrates in health, and Socrates sick. Are they like or unlike?
You mean to compare Socrates in health, as a whole, and Socrates in sickness, as a whole?
Exactly. That is my meaning.
I answer, they are unlike.
And if unlike, they are other?
Certainly.
And would you not say the same of Socrates sleeping and waking, or in any of the states which we were mentioning?
I should.
All agents have a different patient in Socrates, accordingly as he is well or ill.
Of course.
And I who am the patient, and that which is the agent, will produce something different in each of the two cases.
Certainly.
The wine which I drink when I am in health appears sweet and pleasant to me.
True.
For, As has been already acknowledged, the patient and agent meet together and produce sweetness and a perception of sweetness, which are in simultaneous motion, and the perception which comes from the patient makes the tongue percipient, and the quality of sweetness which arises out of and is moving about the wine makes the wine both to be and to appear sweet to the healthy tongue.
Certainly, that has been already acknowledged.
But when I'm sick, the wine really acts upon another and a different person.
Yes.
The combination of the draught of wine and the Socrates who is sick produces quite another result, which is the sensation of bitterness in the tongue, and the motion and creation of bitterness in and about the wine, which becomes not bitterness but something bitter, as I myself become not perception but percipient.
True.
There is no other object of which I shall ever have the same perception, for another object would give another perception, and would make the percipient other and different, nor can that object which affects me, meeting another subject, produce the same, or become similar, for that too will produce another result from another subject, and become different.
True.
Neither can I by myself have this sensation, nor the object by itself, this quality.
Certainly not.
When I perceive I must become percipient of something, there can be no such thing as perceiving and perceiving nothing. The object, whether it becomes sweet, bitter, or of any other quality, must have relation to a percipient. Nothing can become sweet which is sweet to no one.
Certainly not.
Then the inferences, that we the agent and patient are, or become in relation to one another, there is all or which binds us one to the other, but not to any other existence, nor each of us to himself, and therefore we can only be bound to one another, so that whether a person says, that a thing is or becomes, he must say, that it is, or becomes to or of or in relation to something else, but he must not say or allow anyone else to say, that anything is or becomes absolutely, such as our conclusion.
Very true, Socrates.
Then, if that which acts upon me has relation to me, and to no other, and no other and the percipient of it,
of course,
then my perception is true to me, being inseparable from my own being, and, as Protagoras says, to myself I am judge of what is, and what is not to me.
I suppose so.
How then, if I never err, and if my mind never trips in the conception of being or becoming, can I fail of knowing that which I perceive?
You cannot.
Then you are quite right in affirming that knowledge is only perception, and the meaning turns out to be the same, whether with Homer and Heraclitus, and all that company, you say that all is motion and flux, or with the great sage Protagoras, that man is the measure of all things, or with Theaetetus, that, given these premises, perception is knowledge. Am I not right, Theaetetus, and is not this your newborn child, of which I have delivered you? What say you?
I cannot but agree, Socrates.
Then this is the child, however he may turn out, which you and I have with difficulty brought into the world, and now that he is born, we must run round the hearth with him, and see whether he is worth rearing, or is only a wind egg and a sham. Is he to be reared in any case, and not exposed, or will you bear to see him rejected, and not get into a passion, if I take away your firstborn?
Theaetetus will not be angry, for he is very good-natured. But tell me, Socrates, in heaven's name, is this, after all, not the truth?
You, Theodorus, are a lover of theories, and now you innocently fancy that I am a bag full of them, and can easily pull one out which will overthrow its predecessor. But you do not see that in reality none of these theories come from me, they all come from him who talks with me. I only know just enough to extract them from the wisdom of another, and to receive them in a spirit of fairness, and now I shall say nothing myself, but shall endeavor to elicit something from my young friend.
Do as you say, Socrates, you are quite right.
Shall I tell you, Theodorus, what amazes me in your acquaintance Protagoras?
What is it?
I am charmed with his doctrine, that what appears is to each one, but I wonder that he did not begin his book on truth with a declaration that a pig or a dog-faced baboon, or some other yet stranger monster which has sensation, is the measure of all things. Then he might have shown a magnificent contempt for our opinion of him, by informing us at the outset, that while we were reverencing him like a god for his wisdom he was no better than a tadpole, not to speak of his fellow men. Would not this have produced an overpowering effect? For if truth is only sensation, and no man can discern and know those feelings better than he, or has any superior right to determine whether his opinion is true or false, but each, as we have several times repeated, is to himself the sole judge, and everything that he judges is true and right. Why, my friend, should Protagoras be preferred to the place of wisdom and instruction, and deserve to be well paid, and we poor ignoramuses have to go to him, if each one is the measure of his own wisdom, must he not be talking ad captandum in all this? I say nothing of the ridiculous predicament in which my own midwifery and the whole art of dialectic is placed, for the attempt to supervise or refute the notions or opinions of others would be a tedious and enormous piece of folly, if to each man his own are right, and this must be the case, if Protagoras' truth is the real truth, and the philosopher is not merely amusing himself by giving oracles out of the shrine of his book.
He was a friend of mine, Socrates, as you were saying, and therefore I cannot have him refuted by my lips, nor can I oppose you, when I agree with you. Please, then, to take the Aetetus again, he seemed to answer very nicely.
If you were to go into a Lacedaemonian palestra, Theodorus, would you have a right to look on at the naked wrestlers, some of them making a poor figure, if you did not strip and give them an opportunity of judging of your own person?
Why not, Socrates, if they would allow me, as I think you will, in consideration of my age and stiffness, let some more supple youth try a fall with you, and do not drag me into the gymnasium.
Your will is my will, Theodorus, as the proverbial philosophers say, and therefore I will return to the sage Theaetetus. Tell me, Theaetetus, in reference to what I was saying, are you not lost in wonder, like myself, when you find that all of a sudden you are raised to the level of the wisest of men, or indeed of the gods, for you would assume the measure of Protagoras, to apply to the gods as well as men?
Certainly I should, and I confess to you that I am lost in wonder. At first hearing, I was quite satisfied with the doctrine that whatever appears is to each one, but now the face of things has changed.
Why, my dear boy, you are young, and therefore your ear is quickly caught, and your mind influenced by popular arguments. Protagoras, or someone speaking on his behalf, will doubtless say in reply, good people, young and old, you meet and harangue, and bring in the gods, whose existence or non-existence I banish from writing and speech, or you talk about the reason of man being degraded to the level of the brutes, which is a telling argument with the multitude, but not one word of proof or demonstration do you offer. All is probability with you, and yet surely you and Theodorus had better reflect whether you are disposed to admit of probability and figures of speech in matters of such importance. He or any other mathematician who argued from probabilities and likelihoods in geometry would not be worth an ace.
But neither you nor we, Socrates, would be satisfied with such arguments.
Then you and Theodorus mean to say that we must look at the matter in some other way.
Yes, in quite another way.
And the way will be to ask whether perception is or is not the same as knowledge, for this was the real point of our argument, and with a view to this we raised, did we not, those many strange questions.
Certainly.
Shall we say that we know everything which we see and hear? For example, shall we say that not having learned, we do not hear the language of foreigners when they speak to us? Or shall we say that we not only hear, but know what they are saying? Or again, if we see letters which we do not understand, shall we say that we do not see them? Or shall we aver that, seeing them, we must know them?
We shall say, Socrates, that we know what we actually see and hear of them. That is to say, we see and know the figure and color of the letters, and we hear and know the elevation or depression of the sound of them. But we do not perceive by sight and hearing, or know, that which grammarians and interpreters teach about them.
Capital, Theaetetus. And about this there shall be no dispute, because I want you to grow, but there is another difficulty coming, which you will also have to repulse.
What is it?
Someone will say, can a man who has ever known anything, and still has, and preserves a memory of that which he knows, not know that which he remembers at the time when he remembers? I have, I fear, a tedious way of putting a simple question, which is only, whether a man who has learned, and remembers, can fail to know.
Impossible, Socrates, the supposition is monstrous.
Am I talking nonsense? Then, think, is not seeing perceiving, and is not sight perception?
True.
And if our recent definition holds, every man knows that which he has seen.
Yes.
And you would admit that there is such a thing as memory?
Yes.
And is memory of something or of nothing?
Of something, surely.
Of things learned and perceived, that is?
Certainly.
Often a man remembers that which he has seen.
True.
And if he closed his eyes, would he forget?
Who, Socrates, would dare to say so?
But we must say so, if the previous argument is to be maintained.
What do you mean? I am not quite sure that I understand you, though I have a strong suspicion that you are right.
As thus, he who sees knows, as we say, that which he sees. For perception and sight and knowledge are admitted to be the same.
Certainly.
But he who saw, and has knowledge of that which he saw, remembers, when he closes his eyes, that which he no longer sees.
True.
And seeing is knowing, and therefore not seeing is not knowing.
Very true.
Then the inference is, that a man may have attained the knowledge of something, which he may remember, and yet not know, because he does not see, and this has been affirmed by us to be a monstrous supposition.
Most true.
Thus, then, the assertion that knowledge and perception are one, involves a manifest impossibility.
Yes.
Then they must be distinguished.
I suppose that they must.
Once more we shall have to begin, and ask what is knowledge, and yet, Theaetetus, what are we going to do?
About what?
Like a good-for-nothing cock, without having won the victory, we walk away from the argument and crow.
How do you mean?
After the manner of disputers, we were satisfied with mere verbal consistency, and were well pleased, if in this way we could gain an advantage, although professing not to be mere heuristics, but philosophers. I suspect that we have unconsciously fallen into the error of that ingenious class of persons.
I do not as yet understand you.
Then I will try to explain myself. Just now we asked the question, whether a man who had learned and remembered could fail to know, and we showed that a person who had seen might remember when he had his eyes shut, and could not see, and then he would at the same time remember and not know, but this was an impossibility, and so the Protagorean fable came to naught, and yours also, who maintained that knowledge is the same as perception,